Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel for this wintry day. It is a Thursday and we are delighted to have you with us. I'll turn that up for you, yes. Good morning and welcome to our program. Investigative reporter and Albany journalism professor Rosemary Armeo is here. Good morning.
Sorry to have distracted you.
No, that's fine. I'm quite used to it.
At least it's not a sleet intrusion.
I know. I have many questions about your weather report.
Well, we'll talk about that in a moment.
And WAMC's Alan Chartog is here. Good morning, Alan.
Yo!
And, of course, Ray Graff, our newsman, and it's a snowy day. It depends on whether, how snowy depends on where you are
Yes.
near the interstates.
Yes, and you really need a map, because the forecast says it's north of I-90, you get this, south of I-90. So as long as you know where you are in relation to I-90.
But if you're on I-90.
Yeah, I'm listening to the weather forecast. I'm on I-90. There's really a big difference in accumulation north and south. What do I get?
Look. Don't shoot the messenger. All right, you know, this came to me, and I know not of minimal sleet intrusions or anything like that.
You're just following orders.
Because we used to have like counties and areas. Anyway,
what is sleet intrusion?
Well, wouldn't you like to know?
I know.
Here's what happens.
Polar vortex, sleet intrusions. We have new weather this year.
Bombogenesis.
Sounds dirty.
Yes, it does. It does. And frankly, the less said, the better at this point. You'll hear, if you're listening at home, you'll hear weather ad nauseum all day today, and we will keep you apprised of this threat.
So,
or you could look out the window.
Well, that's the other option. That's what we used to do back in my day.
Regardless of where you are near the interstates, it's going to be a snowy day today, and be careful.
And drive safely, and don't drive if you don't have to.
Sit back, listen to the radio. We're here, and just know that we're here for your entertainment. And
if you want to ratchet up the tension, we can bring Christina back in, just to deliver the forecast in breathless tones.
Good morning. Welcome. We welcome your comments as always. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or our Facebook page or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Let's talk about the debt ceiling crisis. GOP Senate leaders avert such a crisis. It was a moment of real drama in a chamber known for, well, you know, maybe not as much drama as this.
Kind of boring.
Yeah, kind of boring. So Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, counted votes on his hand at one point, holding up three fingers as he searched for the remaining votes. Senator John Cornyn of Texas, his number two, paced the Senate floor. What happened next would determine whether their party would again be blamed for triggering a crisis. But when it was clear that they had no choice, the two Republicans who faced primary challenges in the November midterm elections stepped forward in tandem on Wednesday to break their party's filibuster.
Yeah.
I think it's going to help them. I think it's going to help them. There is something in the American spirit which, you know, the Tea Party may do all right. But at some point, people know political courage. And I think this shows political courage both on Boehner's part and on McConnell's part. The other thing is, he, of course, is covering for his people who are afraid of primaries. So they want him to handle it for them, but they're not going to vote with him. But in the end, they're going to be extraordinarily grateful to him for having taken care of it, and to both of those guys, to having taken care of it. And that's already being shown.
The interesting thing to me was that Ted Cruz messed this all up. The deal was to pass this, but only on the votes of Democrats. And the Democrats had enough votes to pass it, and then all the Republicans could have voted no and gone back home and said, see, we stood up for fiscal responsibility. It was those damn Democrats. And Cruz, however, starts a filibuster. And these two leaders had to do the right thing. They could have broken the deal, held up the debt ceiling, hurt the American economy, really. And and they did the right thing. That's great. They're, of course, being lauded like heroes now for doing what seems like kind of
their jobs.
So why did he do it? In other words, why did Cruz do it? Was it just so that he called some attention to himself? Guy is thinking he could be president of the United States?
Boy, that's a good question, Alan. What do you think about it? I think you just named it. He's really just very full of himself.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of thing that will get you detested in a club like the United States Senate.
Right.
You know, it is a club, and there are certain rules. Okay, you can attack Republicans, attack Democrats, and the other way around. But you don't mess things up when there seems to be a deal that's going to help everybody.
Exactly.
And I think he thinks that this is the way he gets out front.
When you think about the just talk a little bit about the tension, the pacing, everybody walking around. Is this something that lasts? I mean, you could say, okay, this is something that shows the divisions within the Republican Party. But how does this last, and what effect do you think it has on future fights, both with the Democrats and within the party?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think this is good for the Republicans. This is not that good for the Democrats because, you know, Obama really had them when he said, I'm not going to attach anything to it. And if you people think you're going to close down the government because of this, you know, while he doesn't speak in that stride, see, that's what he was really saying.
Yeah.
So along come these two leaders and they say nothing doing. We're not going to go through that again. We did it with former speakers and we've done it again ourselves. And we know what the American people think of it, and we hate it. So in the end, the Democrats, which had a terrific issue on this, don't have it the same way anymore.
Is it good for us, though? Is it good for the American people that we have a debt ceiling and we're set?
Of course, yeah. And John McCain, I have to say, in the Senate side, on the Republican side, fought mightily for this. It's just, I mean, there will be lots of places for Democrats and Republicans to disagree. This is not the one. America's got to pay its bills. Come on.
And the Congress is the one who created those bills.
Yep.
I mean, it isn't as if Obama's spending the money. The Congress passes the budget. The Congress says yes. And then they say, well, we're not going to vote for the extension. And by the way, I do think that it's a little disingenuous on the part of some of the people who hate this huge debt because things are being done.
Yeah, I was going to bring that. I was going to bring that up, Alan, that they are not. They don't take an absolute position when it helps them. They just back down on a cut in military pensions because the veterans just went crazy over it. And so there was bipartisan support, and those pensions are now restored. So some of the cuts have come back on. There's a way to negotiate settlements here between what we spend our money on and how fast we're cutting.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We always welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Healthy Living Market and Cafe, Saratoga Springs, featuring the Divine Wine Store with wines from all over the world with pairings, monthly tastings, and events, healthylivingmarket.com. And First Care Walk-In Medical Center, Route 299, Highland, New York, occupational medical care for workplace injuries 7 days a week, DOT and other physical examinations, drug testing, and more, firstcaremedcenter.com.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel and our discussion. Ray Graff is here, Rosemary Armeo, and Alan Chartok, and we welcome your input as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Let's talk about the former mayor of the city of New Orleans, guilty of 20 counts of bribery and fraud. And reading this story, I knew that there were charges, and I knew obviously there was a trial going on, but I had no idea to the extent of what he was accused of and what he was ultimately found guilty, convicted of. So a former corporate executive became mayor in 2002, pledging to modernize city government, and instead became an emblem of government dysfunction in the months and years after Hurricane Katrina. Was found guilty in federal court on Wednesday on 20 counts of bribery and fraud. The verdict marks a dubious milestone in a city long associated with ethically loose style of politics. However, it makes Mr. Nagin the first New Orleans mayor to be charged, tried, and convicted of corruption. He was found guilty of all but one of 21 counts, including bribery, wire fraud, and filing false tax returns. Sentencing has been set for June 11th, which happens to be his 58th birthday. He could face 20 years in prison by federal sentencing guidelines. And so a lot really here, but as we stated, most of this had to do with post-Katrina, what was done with the money that was coming in, and he ultimately testified in court that he had little control over the contracting process and described some of the payoffs as legitimate investments in his son's business. In one case involving a contractor's $10,000 payment to Mr. Nagin's son, the jury agreed with Mr. Nagin, but they sided with the government on the rest, a total of illicit profits that the government put at $500,000.
Yeah, it's pretty despicable, very despicable. And he was the face of Katrina, and many people liked him. He spoke out about the government then, about treatment that the city got. And then he did this most despicable act of bilking contractors who were rebuilding the city after the storm.
But it's clear that some of these allegations predate the hurricane.
I thought you may be right about that, but some of them date from right afterwards.
Yeah,
I think most of the money, when we start talking about the contractors and all of that, that all has to do with post-Katrina.
That's when he had all the opportunity, all the contracts, or all the orders were coming in for work. But his testimony.
Allegedly, here's a guy who walks into a restaurant with a bunch of people, pays the bill, but pays it on a city account. And says, listen, when I'm mayor for 24 hours a day, somebody's always going to come up to me and they're going to talk to me, which all goes to show that anybody can rationalize anything. And, you know, there's a sense of entitlement with these guys who are so corrupt. They do it again and again and again, and they think it's okay and they get away with it a little bit. They do it a lot more. In the end, we see it all the time. We saw it in the New York State Senate, a whole leadership cadre who were doing the same thing. There is something quite sick about the whole thing.
Yeah, and you may be right, Alan, about that sense of entitlement. This guy was a businessman before he went into public service, and he often talked about taking a 300% pay cut.
Yeah.
So to have some of those riches and wealth restored by gifts and little presents just didn't seem so awful to him, I think.
From the witness stand, he testified that the extensive paper trail in which much of the case rested, calendar entries, tax filings, legal documents, and city paperwork, was mostly handled by others, like accountants or assistants. His lawyer asked whether a person taking bribes would really be so careless as to leave such a record, behavior that brazenly flouts the wisdom shared by a former Louisiana governor, Earl Long, that one should never put in writing what one can convey in a smile, a nod, or a wink. And then there is a pause in the article, and it says, those who knew him say it is unsurprising.
Yeah, he was not just a crook, but a bad crook.
So we'll see what happens at sentencing. And I have to say, Alan, I don't know how you feel about this, but it seems 20 years kind of surprises me.
Throw the book at him.
Well yeah, I mean, that's what I mean.
I do these stories all the time in Eastern Europe, where this is what he did was business as usual. And what's different in the United States is the police stopped him, arrested him, brought him to trial, convicted him, and now he cannot get a slap on the wrist. This, you do not betray the public trust.
Yeah. By the way, I think what the story said, as I heard it, was that the sentencing guidelines say 20 years. The
yes.
federal sentencing guidelines.
Yes, that's true.
Say 20 years. That doesn't mean he got 20 years.
No, I mean, I'm saying even if he gets 20 years, that doesn't seem enough to me.
Oh, good.
Oh, really?
No, I thought you were saying it was too much. No, that seems like a harsh sentence to me. As a harsh sentence.
We don't put people away for vehicular homicide or child abuse for 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true, Rosemary. But I think that what we're seeing here is that the feds are determined to bring. Preet Bharara does it in New York. They want to bring these people up, and they want to use them as examples, make examples out of them, and say, "You better cut it out. You better just stop it." That's why they have to get. Why they've come after Bruno three times already.
You're right.
I mean, this is crazy.
You are right. And as I say, I think this is important to democracy. It's what's missing in places around the world that I cover.
And to your point, Alan, as far as, you know, the guidelines could be 20 years, but, you know, you could be looking at 10 and then be out of jail in 5 or 6 years.
Could be. But by that time, people will say, Ray who? The reason that they are so going to be so intent on making the case and then making sure that they do it, as I've said too many times now, they want to make an example out of them.
We're going to take a break. We're going to go to NPR News. When we return, we'll continue with many other issues to discuss. We welcome your comments. Roundtable@WAMC.org. A reminder, you can also comment on our webpage or our Facebook page or our Twitter page at WAMC Roundtable. We'd love to hear from you. We'll continue after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable and our panel discussion this morning. Let me reintroduce the group. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here, newsman Ray Graff, and University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary R. Mayo. We welcome your comments, roundtable@WAMC.org. As we jump back into the stories, we look at this one, which is by special request from Rosemary Mayo.
Is this a long-distance dedication?
That's right. This is an article from the Washington Post. What do the jobless do when the benefits end? It's a fascinating story. The end to federal jobless benefits for nearly 2 million people has sparked a bitter debate in Congress about whether Washington is abandoning desperate households or simply protecting strained government coffers. It is also providing real-time answers to a question economists have long pondered. How do people survive when they suddenly have no money coming in? Studies show that about a third of the people cut off from long-term unemployment benefits will find help from Social Security or other government programs. Others will cobble together dwindling savings or support from family and family members. But most baffling to economists are the people who appear to come up with more idiosyncratic solutions, which are tough to identify and almost impossible to track. And it's a fascinating look at how ultimately people deal with not having anything.
Yeah. I love this story. And of course, I've covered this also in places like Bosnia where there's a war. There is no economy. There are people who go to jobs because you have to have something to do during the day. So they would go to jobs there, but wouldn't get paid or couldn't be assured of getting paid for 3 months at a time, 6 months at a time. So how did they live? And this story says economists are looking at it here and they don't really know. But you sort of, if they looked at other places, you would know. They borrow from friends. They steal. They gamble. They grow their own gardens for the first time. You create services. There's a woman in this article they talked to who was filling out forms for students in her neighborhood who are trying to apply for aid, school aid. And those forms are real complicated. So she would fill them out for them for a small fee. You just put together something to hold body and soul together. I think it would be a terrible situation. How do you pay your mortgage, your utility bills, and feed your family? Ugh.
And it's hard to figure out, because it's one of those things where you understand the first one of, okay, you go to another program. You understand the second one of, you try to get as whatever you can, liquidate whatever you can.
Right. Sell it.
Friends, families, whatever you can do. And then your third option, you know, question mark. Yeah. You know, what do you
And
do?
No one cares about you.
Not even others.
Being counted. I'm sorry, Alan. Go ahead.
No, there are some others, like homelessness. The reason homelessness increases is because people have no home anymore and they go out on the streets. And when you hear them interviewed on various programs, they always say that, you know, ran out. The other thing, of course, is Susan Barnett did a wonderful program yesterday on 51% about prostitution. And when all else fails, that's one thing that is still there. These are horrible choices, but that's what people do.
Right.
Are we getting do you think that this is much of this article is economists trying to figure it out?
Right.
Do you think they'll figure it out?
I think there's a lot of information that already exists, not in the United States, because we haven't created a situation like this before where we don't support anybody. But it certainly happens in other places in the world.
And all under this heading of long-term unemployment.
Nice move, Republicans. Yeah, good way to cut the deficit.
Again, we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org, WAMC.org. The Olympics are going on in Sochi and in Russia, and it's safe to say, I think, that the Americans are doing very poorly. And so this is starting to make the news. And it's kind of, there's a LA Times story about this, which I find fascinating, where any pretty much any sport that we were expected to do very well in, we're coming in 8th or 10th or 11th. And I don't know, is that a big deal?
I mean, where are we in the medal count? 5th, 6th?
I thought we were at one. We're second now,
okay. I mean,
but I thought we were like 8th at one point. But yes,
we're doing fine. You know,
does it?
Would you rather have an Olympics, and we've seen them before, where we dominate? I mean, I'd rather have an Olympics where there is some sort of competition going on, and we're still doing fine. You know, maybe not taking the gold here and there, but I don't know. I think it's been a great Olympics.
Yeah, it has. It's been wonderful to watch.
Yep.
And I looked at reasons that the U.S. might drop. This is in comparison to Vancouver, where we did dominate.
Yeah.
We've dropped
That's
in comparison
boring,
to
be
that.
Honest with you.
But there's no like decrease in funding for training. There's
nope.
no loss of facilities. We're just building. We had a great super team, and now we're building.
It's like
we'll
the Mets.
Be back again.
They won a World Series in 86, and they've been rebuilding for 30 years. I mean, that's the way it works.
Well, I think athletes in other countries are also really soaring in ways that they had not before. There's money going into their training and care in places like China and Korea that we have not seen before. So
I think it's
interesting.
Okay. It's cyclical and it's fine.
And I guess I think the story of why the story is a story, to me anyway, is because of all of these big names who are expected to come in and dominate have not dominated. So you have someone like Shaun White.
That was great.
And many others who just haven't done what they thought they were going to do and ultimately have ended up in a position of coming in 8th or last or something.
You know, from a purely physical stance here, there are variables that affect games of any kind. So if you're playing a football game where Joe's team is heavily favored, but my God, we had a blizzard and it's snowy and terrible, then suddenly my team, which is the underdog, has a different advantage. So what's happening in Russia is that the weather's really warm and the track is really bad.
Yeah,
so
the conditions are awful.
I mean, not for curling and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the half
the
pipe.
The half pipe was a mess.
Yeah.
Right.
And these, I was watching the, I don't know, there was Super G or whatever, the skiing yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
It was 50 degrees. So the conditions
thing.
Were very bad.
Well, and they were showing the slush. However, you know, there are athletes who are using that and saying, I can do it.
Is then you lose that predictability.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're right.
Shaun White, who is supposed to come back with, I don't know, 4 medals, and he strategizes his way to 0 medals, was so gracious in defeat. It was really one of the, I thought, most riveting moments of the Olympics coverage, where he just said, you know, these guys are incredibly talented. They're all at about the same level, you know, and it is luck and daring and skill, and he missed it.
He had a bad day. He had two bad runs.
Right.
Yep, and that's it.
He was very gracious about it. That's good. There's something to be said for sportsmanship as a sport.
Current medal count as of right now has the United States with 4 golds, 2 silvers, and 6 bronze, 12 medals overall, which Germany has the most gold medals with 8 overall, and Canada in second with 4 gold medals, 4 silver, and 2 bronze. So
it's all good.
Yeah,
Let it roll. Let it roll.
We'll see what happens. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and talk about some other sports stories, actually.
Terrific.
Derek Jeter's retiring.
Oh, boy.
You're listening to the Bringing Ian. He's still crying. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Buttermilk Falls Inn, Milton, taking reservations for dinners, spa days, and weekend escapes on a 75-acre Hudson Riverfront estate with lodging, a farm-to-table restaurant, and spa, buttermilkfallsinn.com. And Beacon Institute for Rivers and Estuaries of Clarkson University, accepting applications for RiverU, a 6-credit undergrad summer program in river ecology, green engineering, and policy in Beacon and aboard the Clearwater, riveru.org.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And the big business news today is that Comcast has said it has agreed to buy Time Warner Cable for $45 billion in a deal that would combine the two biggest cable companies in the United States. If the deal is approved, the combined group will be the country's dominant provider of television channels and internet services. Time Warner Cable owners will be offered Comcast shares for each share that they own, 2.875, valuing Time Warner Cable at about $158.82 a share. The two companies expect the merger to take effect by the end of the year, but regulators are likely to take a close look at the potential impact on consumers. I don't know what that means because I don't know what.
Yeah, is my bill going up? Is my cable bill going up?
And will I lose channels and, you know, services?
Is Comcast going to be better to deal with than Time Warner? These are the issues I have.
Well, they are issues. And also the question about, and Alan, I'm curious as to what you think about this. So often they talk about regulators taking a close look for the impact on consumers and saying, okay, in these situations, is this a monopoly? And
it can't be good. I mean, let's face it. It just can't be good.
Why?
When you take... Well, because it's
when the big get bigger,
monopoly, absolutely. So the number one, and they just better keep their hands off the meat channel and the rifleman. That's all.
Yeah, well, I think that was probably part of what the regulators will be looking at the whole rifleman situation.
The other thing, I mean, we kid about, you know, what impact is it going to have on our shows and our channels and so forth. But for so long, as part of this, as part of regulation and questions have emerged, is making cable TV pay as you go, that instead of getting these elaborate packages that have everything, that you pay per item, per channel,
really
for what you really use and what you really want. This is something the cable companies have obviously fought vigorously against and so far have been successful in doing so. But to Alan's point, if you have a company that's getting bigger and bigger and more powerful, where does that leave issues like that?
Well, I mean, also, yes, I can see the point, but it also will lower costs and potentially, I mean, obviously that often doesn't work in the real world, could potentially lower costs for consumers.
Do you really think your bill's going to go down?
Absolutely not. Just saying.
I don't see that happening.
You're right, though. There is a potential for that. What happens to the savings, you know? Oh, wait, never mind. Shareholders. I remember. Economics 101.
And
the guy ran for president and he said or for mayor and said the rent is too damn high, and I'm going to guarantee you the cable bills are too high. Every time I see a cable bill around here, I almost faint. They keep getting higher. It's just unbelievable.
Well, part of that is the, you know, agreements that have to be struck between the cable providers and the networks, and in theory a bigger company of merged Time Warner and Comcast has more leverage to make better deals with some of these networks. Now, again, whether a consumer sees $1 of savings is a question.
So how many times have you gone?
Not a question. I just think it's
very simple.
No, our bills are going to come. Yes, it is. Our bills will continue to go up. Period. End of story. Punto final.
All right.
But you know, so much is changing, and Marketplace made this point right before we came on the air about an hour ago about how cable is changing, how we view television is changing. More and more pay-per-view. More and more are we getting from the internet. More and more are we going to other sources. So to remain competitive, they're going to have to do something.
Yes, but that's whether or not this merger happened or happens. That is the case.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But they're going to be a major force in that discussion.
I still like my cable. Okay, I like it a lot.
I'm also wondering about Time Magazine, too. Isn't that part of this?
No, they spun that off. I think Time Warner spun that off.
Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
AOL was part. Wow. What a bizarre history that firm has gone through.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Trying to find a niche in the media world.
And Warner, I mean, there was a point where Warner Brothers, the studio was a part of it, which is why we had Roadrunner, but then they lost the Roadrunner.
Right, right.
So it was part of it anymore, so it's interesting.
It would be interesting to look at the family trees of these firms.
And go back.
So they spun off Time, but they still kept it as part of the name. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, that name's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens with Comcast and ultimately Time Warner Cable. I wonder if Bill Cowher's out of a job.
Yeah, he'll have a job coaching the Giants within the next 2 years, so he'll be fine.
Speaking of baseball changes.
We're talking football there, but still. I like the seg.
I can't believe I said that.
No, it's fine. The Giants are a baseball team as well.
It's safe to say that that there are sports fans around the nation, certainly in our state and in our region, that are bereft, as they found out yesterday afternoon in a Facebook post that Derek Jeter, at age 39, has said this will be my final season. He was out for a good portion of last season, and he made comments earlier in the week about how it was important to have the team move on past A-Rod, and then just a few days later announced that he would be leaving the team at the end of the season. And assuming if he's healthy, he'll have his last game in, well, maybe October, but certainly late September.
It's great. I mean, it's great. He's had a great career. The fact that he is retiring, one of the 10 greatest Yankees of all time, up there with Babe Ruth and Gehrig and everybody else. The fact that he's retiring is not a huge deal. The fact that he announced it on Facebook is a huge deal. This whole society has changed. He made this announcement on Facebook.
In other words, not going to 60 Minutes or to ESPN or to Sports Illustrated or to the holding a press conference, right?
To the Yankees press operation.
By the way, peeps, I'm retiring, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, I can only assume that you know, he told his employers. I assume they had something to. I'm sure they knew about
things
it.
Things can change as well.
Well, I don't know. He seems pretty sincere. The other question, I mean, the thing I love about this story is you have a kid who always wanted to be a Yankee, who grew up wanting to be a Yankee, and he goes into the major leagues. He becomes a New York Yankee, and he remains the whole time a New York Yankee. And to end his career as a Yankee, I just think is a lovely story. It's a great, great sports story.
And what happens to more and more rare these days.
Well, I mean, it's incredibly rare these days.
What happens to Yankee stars?
What do you mean?
What's next for him? He's 39 years old.
A lot of good things will happen to him. I mean, what could bad happen to him? Millions of dollars, just a great life ahead of him. He's still young. But
you assume, as most of the, I mean, just to, I'll let you, but I assume, Alan, are you going to weigh in on this?
Only to say that he once played ball in Albany, and that's where our Ian Pickus, our news director, first saw him, and for the Albany Colony Yankees, and thought he was just the greatest. So, you know, our Ian always knows a good ball player when he sees one.
Excellent. Indeed, he does. So
I have something else. One other thing, and that is he's retiring at the end of the year. But let's say he has a great year. You think nobody's ever changed their minds?
Right you are.
You know, unless the deal, you know, they just said, look, this is where we are. We have this is the contract, and this is what we have. And not to say it can't be changed, but I don't know.
He's one of the all-time greats. Even people who hate the Yankees respect and love Derek Jeter.
Absolutely.
And as a Mets fan, could not care less possibly what happens to the Yankees. You got to love this guy. He is right there with DiMaggio, Mantle, Ruth. He's number two, will be retired. That's another single-digit number you'll never get on the Yankees again. I don't know if there are any left after after two. And he's just one of the all-time greats. It's rare that in our lifetime we saw an old-school baseball player in that same ilk. He stayed with his team. He played at a high level. He was a classy guy. I mean, Jeter.
Yeah, and he was and I think to answer Rosemary's question, I mean, I would be surprised if he is not a vital part of the Yankees organization moving forward.
If he wants to be.
You know, if he wants to be.
If he's not in Monte Carlo with models on each arm playing roulette or whatever he would do, you know.
Is that the dream retirement?
Well, that's my dream retirement. But in radio, sadly, that doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen as often, though. Exactly. Is that what you're saying?
No, the red convertible and midlife crisis is all I have to look forward to, actually. Grab some Flomax. I mean, you know.
Well, I got two of the three. and then finally we add on a sad note. I think this is, Bray and I were talking about this earlier. I'm sure Alan will chime in as well on this. To me, one of the great, one of the television greats was Sid Caesar. I think he created, pretty much created a television, and as far as variety television and the variety show, he came at a time where not only were we dealing with a brand new medium, but when you look at the writers, and this has been said a million times, but the writers on that show. Of Neil Simon and
Woody Allen,
Mel Brooks, and Carl Reiner. And I mean,
Larry
this is Gelman. Absolutely well, there we go.
Gelbart,
who created was MASH. It was an incredible group. He was an incredible performer, and then you have the people who were around him: Carl Reiner, Imogene Coca, and so forth. And it was he was a master. At television comedy, and singularly one of the funniest people I've ever seen in my life.
What a loss.
Yeah.
It makes you weep. Gleason, Caesar, they're gone. They're gone, and so many hacks live on.
And so many young listeners will not even know really who you're talking about.
I don't care.
You know, there is a...
Well, I'm impressed that you guys remember.
Well, I think Sid Caesar had such an impact and was relevant for so long. He had a vital career post television. He was certainly a regular on the circuit. He would I don't think it was, you know, I said not all that long ago, it was probably 15, 20 years ago, but he was doing dates at Proctor's and other theaters in our region where he would go out and recreate some of these wonderful sketches that he had done. And
I just have a fond feeling of him because of my parents. It was my parents' generation who loved him. Early television really was stinky. I mean, it's Milton Berle and drag and wrestling. And so Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca just stood so out as talented that they talked about him all the time.
Can you imagine NBC having lost, quote, unquote, lost all the kinescopes of your show of shows?
Wow.
There were a few that they saved on their own, and that's how they did the movie. But imagine the stupidity of network executives. Oh, yeah, we've
they're
got
old.
It.
Yeah. They're not going to last.
Yeah.
Yeah. A great...
And of course, you make a good point, Ray. It was all live.
Yep.
That was what was so fascinating by the whole thing. I mean, you had a 90-minute show live. You had to meet the targets, the posts, and all the rest of it. And then a 60-minute show in which you had to do that. Unbelievable.
Sid Caesar, your show of shows. We are our show. This part of it is run out of time, but we thank you all very much for being here, and we'll reconvene tomorrow. Rosemary's already out the door.
Yeah, me too.
You're listening to the Roundtable
on WAMC.